Kenny Bernstein is with us on Sports Byline, former NHRA driver and team owner, now retired from both. And Kenny, we talked in the last segment about the relationship with the fan. I wonder if we can go into that a little bit more, because, you know, if you look at professional sports, there seems to be a disconnect between fans and the sport and the athlete. That has never been the case across all of motor racing. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because motor racing is much more down to earth and much more accessible. Now, I know that in our sport, drag racing, that's maintained itself for 60 years with the National Hot Rod Association. We've always allowed the fans into the pit area, or what we would call our locker room, so they can stand right next to us, basically, and we're accessible to them. We go out and sign autographs constantly throughout the day, and it's always been that way. So I think in our sport, the people can really get next to the driver and really get to know what they're all about. NASCAR was that way in the beginning. I think it's a little tougher there now, but it's still at least accessible to some degree. But and the difference, I think, in our program versus football or baseball or basketball, we have sponsors to take care of, and we have to take care of their customers. So that puts us into the fan face also by those monster sponsors that we have to go and make sure that we take care of their customers, which turns into being fans, which just continues to spread.
What did you find is the dynamic difference between CART, NHRA, and NASCAR when you were a three-team owner?
Well, they were entirely different, all three forms. It was quite different. Drag racing is what it is, what I've just explained. NASCAR was just before the boom hit, and it was much like drag racing. The fans there were phenomenal and fantastic, and the competitors and the owners were just wonderful people to us down there. They were absolutely just wonderful and very enjoyable to be down there. That was prior to the boom that hit there, and I don't know how it is today. IndyCar is a little bit different. It was a little tougher there only because it was an organization called CART. It was owned by the owners themselves. So you had some pretty high-powered people in the boardroom, so to speak, that really ran the situation. But they were good to us there. The fans were a crossover also. They were really, really nice to us. And we had great times in all three, but they were quite different. NASCAR was run by Mr. France, and Mr. France, it was his way or the highway, and CART was run by a board, and then drag racing was run by Dallas Gardner at that time, and Wally Parks, of course. So, but the one at the NASCAR, I mean, it was Mr. France was great because he just didn't put up with anything.
When you think about having been involved with all three circuits at the same time, do you kind of shake your head wondering how you even did that?
You know, I really do. Over the years, I look back at that time and go, my goodness me. One, it was very difficult even during the time it was going on for those 10 years. It was a really tough game. You know, I'm not a real good, as you know, Ron, absentee owner, so being in three places at once was very difficult, and fortunately I had great people. But even then, it was really tough from this side for me, is that we would maybe have great success one weekend with drag racing, but the other two wouldn't have success. So even though I was happy, I was sad, and I was concerned on the other side. Or if the other side had winning that weekend, then I was concerned with the other one. So it didn't ever seem like you could have a happy weekend across the board. Just every now and then we would get all three of them looking good on one weekend, and you'd feel really good about it. But the pressure was always there for me to perform across the board, not just in drag racing. Fortunately, at that time, in drag racing, we were running really good and dominating the funny car world. It made my life somewhat easier than it would have been if we'd been struggling on that side.
Did you ever feel like the little Dutch boy trying to put your finger in all the holes in the dike?
I couldn't find the holes fast enough. I couldn't get there quickly enough in some cases, to be honest about it. And that's ultimately what drove me out of doing all three, was it just got too hard, too much travel, too difficult to satisfy all the customers, so to speak. And I've always been one, as you know, my dad taught me from the beginning, give the customer what they deserve and what they want, and give them more than they pay for. And we always did that, and I think in some ways that leads to some serious problems and burnout when you try to do that all the time.
Let me go back again to your announcement that you were leaving the sport. You say, we salute the late, great NHRA founder, Wally Parks. Talk to me a little bit about his vision for this sport and also what he did in developing it along the way.
Well, Wally was unique, and he did find the sport. He started it, and it was really started as a club and as a safety issue type thing to get kids off the street. What I meant by that was, without his vision, without him even starting this NHRA, this might not have even happened for us over the 30 years. Maybe it would have never come about, but it was because of his tenacity and his wife Barbara and all the people that he had around him in those days that this whole thing even got started. One thing at Wally and I, we were really good friends. We did a lot of talking about business and sponsorships because in the early days there were no sponsors. And when we brought Budweiser in, that kind of set the tone to get corporate America looking our way. And I enjoyed talking about that. The one thing that Wally and I disagreed on constantly was he always thought the cars were the stars, and I argued night and day with him that it was the drivers and the owners and the crew chiefs were the stars of the sport, and we had to build around the drivers to make them stars, to make those people, the fans follow those drivers, just like NASCAR has in the NBA and NFL, and all of them have.
I know that when I talk to NFL players that are rookies and I ask them about the step up from college football to the NFL, they always talk to me about the speed of the game. Now, in 1989, you announced the decision to move from funny cars to top fuel dragsters. Take me through that decision to step up, and what did you find as the difference?
Well, first of all, the reason for that was Dale Armstrong and I, my crew chief at the time, decided that we had accomplished everything we could do on the funny car side, and we were both looking for a new challenge. And I had never driven a rear-engine dragster at that time. I started with front-engine cars, but not rear, and Dale had done both, so he was well familiar. But we just looked for a new challenge, and we thought that that would be a good place to go. We didn't realize at the time what all it would entail in the sense of what could be accomplished there other than winning. We certainly didn't look out there and say, wow, 300 mile an hour is coming. We want to be the first to do that. Fortunately, we were the first.
Yeah, 1992 was when you became the first driver to break that 300 mile per hour barrier. In 94, you became the first driver to break the 310 mile per hour barrier. How psychological was that to the sport? Why was that an important, the 300 mile an hour barrier so important to the sport?
Well, one, it's a phenomenal number to think a car can go 300 miles an hour in a little over 4.5 seconds in a quarter mile. I don't think anyone on this earth ever thought that, well, I know guys didn't think we'd break 180, much less 300. And that was the next barrier that was out there and the last barrier of drag racing. There will be no more barriers. There's no more things to hit. You're not going to see 350 or 400 in this game because the rules today won't allow that to happen. And we don't need to go that fast anyway. It's fast enough the way it is. But the 300 barrier was just the last one out there, and it was such a phenomenal barrier, meaning how fast it was. When you say someone, you go 300 miles an hour in 4.6 seconds or 7 seconds or 4.5 seconds, that's a pretty unique situation. So that's why it's so important.
Was it also psychological for the sport? I mean, it was that apple out at the end of the stick, and everybody from a technological standpoint, from a driving standpoint, they all wanted to see if they could break that barrier, Kenny?
Well, everyone was shooting for it. There's no question. It's just a matter of who did it first. That's true. But the biggest thing, I think, for the 300, it transcended this sport across the board of motorsports world. People that are in other forms of motorsports realize what kind of a feat that is. NASCAR, IndyCar, Formula One. We got letters and notes and calls and faxes from all over the racing world. When I went to the races the next week, which was a NASCAR race after 300, I was walking up the stands to go on top to spot for my team that weekend, and the fans erupted with, there's the 300-mile-an-hour, congratulations, Kenny, 300. So it just went across the whole motorsports world because it was such a feat. It was unheard of that a car could go 300 miles an hour. You just couldn't believe it, and I think that's what helped the sport tremendously at that time. It was a great shot in the arm for it.
Bobby Rahal once said something to me. He's a guy that, like myself, wanted to fly and, of course, has the Coke bottle thick glasses and everything. But he said, if a car or a plane is going 300 miles an hour, you better be thinking 301 miles per hour.
Yeah, Bobby's great, and he's a great friend of mine. And we were together with the Budweiser days when he was with Budweiser, and he's right. But it's funny about cars. When you're in the seat driving these cars, and NASCAR, any of them for that matter, I'm sure that your mind is so far ahead of what that car is going through at that particular time. You're thinking way ahead, but you're doing it in slow motion. And everything inside my race car always felt like slow motion. That 4.5 seconds and a quarter mile to me felt like 2 or 3 minutes. And many a time I would get to the finish line and not really know how I got there because everything you did was so easy and so much in your mind and so subconscious that you were just way ahead of the car and thinking what was going to happen and where you were on the racetrack at that point in time.
Do you know, Kenny, when it broke through, when technology took over more than maybe just the driving? Now, I know how important the driving is, but
right.
It seems to me that technology at some point overtook just the driving.
Well, it all happened when Dale Armstrong, my crew chief, decided to put a computer on the car. When he finally figured out, him and Ron Armstrong and Spencer Eisenhardt developed a computer that could live in the environment, and it was really just a data recorder, but it gave us so much information that we never knew before, things that we had to look at and just guess at by looking at the parts and pieces. Now we had it verified by a computer, by a graph, and we could see. And then as that computer grew and more outlets were put on the computer to test more things and to look at more things, that changed this whole sport. That was the one thing that changed this sport to the high-tech technology side of things. And it's unbelievable today the amount of channels that we go on these computers and see things. Now, in our sport, the computer cannot do anything while the car is going down the racetrack. It's strictly a recorder. But it's information now you do not have to guess at, and that was the biggest change in that.
Acceleration and deceleration took its toll on your body, and in 2003, you walked away and turned the car over to your son, Brandon. What was the driving force to make you get out of the cockpit?
Well, I felt at that time that it was time to get out. I felt like that we had proven everything we needed to do. I was satisfied with walking away, I thought at that time, and as it turned out, I probably wasn't. But I just felt like the time was to do that. I felt that with Budweiser, we were with them, and they were touting a younger audience, trying to grab that younger audience and get away from the beer that was their father's beer type of image. And so we just picked a period of time that we felt was right, that all of us were comfortable with, and made that switch at that time. And like I said, I was fine with it then, and you know, as it turned out, maybe I wasn't quite ready yet. But that's something you never know till you get out. But I wasn't ready yesterday either, Ron.
Do you think Brandon was ready? Because, of course, at Englishtown, he had that accident and forced you back into the cockpit of the car.
Right, right. Yeah, Brandon got hurt real bad in the eighth race of his rookie year and broke his back. And so we got back in the car and finished out the season and had a good season, finished it up really good. And then Brandon came back, and then off we go again. And I was good getting back out again. It's really kind of a strange feeling. When I got back in, I was glad to be back in. I was sorry for my son being hurt so badly, obviously, and he was here at my house, and we took care of him, 24/7 until he could get back going again. But it was a good feeling to race again and to win some races. And when I got out, I felt real good about myself and felt good about the team, and I was glad Brandon was going back in.
When you think back for just a moment about all you accomplished, all you did, how much the sport meant to you, how much you meant to motorsports and particularly NHRA, what are the memories that are so poignant to you, Kenny?
Well, there's three things that are the most important to me. One, the personnel that's been with me and the people that have worked for me, crew chiefs on down to the PR, Susie Arnold, to everyone that's been with me. Cheryl, by all means, my right-hand man and person, my wife, who's been and danced every dance. But the people that have been with us that have through the years of all forms of racing, NASCAR and IndyCar, that's really important to me, because the success would have never happened without those people. One person doesn't do any of this, as you know. Secondly, the fans and how much they support us through the years. And thirdly, the press, the side of it that we're doing right now. People like you, Ron Barr, that gave us the opportunity to spread the gospel about NHRA drag racing and Budweiser and Copart and Kenny Bernstein Racing. Those are the three things that I take away from this the most. All the accomplishments were great, and the fun that we did with them was wonderful, but those three things are more important to me.
In about 20 seconds, any regrets?
No, I don't. Who knows if there's regret, Ron? Right now we're kind of in a we've had some blow-up days where we don't feel so good about it. We're concerned that we made the right decision. But when you get down to it and look at it and figure everything out, put it down on a piece of paper, it was the right decision. I don't know how you could ever walk away from something that you've loved as much as we've loved this for 32 years and not have some regret. The question is are you going to be able to go on with your life and enjoy it? And I believe we will, and that's the most important. Sure, right now we have some regret only because it's a different program for us entirely.
Kenny Bernstein with us. Kenny, I appreciate our friendship. Take care, my friend, and come back and join us on Sports Byline.
Well, Ron, you know it. I love it and love you so much. Thank you.
Kenny once said, for a youngster that grew up in Texas dreaming about cars and reading hot rod magazines, we were able to live our dream. I'm Ron Barr. We continue with more of you in Sports Byline.